want to return to it. It is really important not to spend too much time on the individual civilization trees at the expense of some larger generalizations. The most obvious point, in addition to the separate flavor of each case, the most obvious point about the classical period is that it gains coherence from two very, very simple developments. Simple to say, not as easy to flesh out and explain. First of all of these societies, as mentioned before, were territorially much larger than their river valley predecessors. China expanded geographically several times over. The classical Mediterranean had obviously never previously been a unit at all. The Persian Empire was larger than virtually any of its river valley predecessors. And Indian civilization, in spreading through the subcontinent, also embraced a territory vastly larger and more diverse and complicated than Harappan civilization had been previously. The reasons for expansion? Doubtless several. Crucial was the fact that these civilizations, in contrast to their river valley predecessors, all had access to iron. Iron technologies began to be introduced from about 1500 BCE onward. They would serve, obviously, to underwrite a much more elaborate and effective production technology. And perhaps more obviously, they would underwrite considerable expansion of military capacity. The most obvious single reason, then, that these societies are so much larger than their river state predecessors is they were operating on a different technological base. Equally clearly, leaders in these societies, the Greek leaders who wanted to expand the Greek Empire in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Athenian Empire or its analogs, the Chinese leaders who pressed into the south, leaders in these societies saw clear advantages in terms of potential population expansion, resource expansion, in enlarging their economic, cultural, and political territories, and this becomes part of the operation as well. Conceivably, as a third factor, the fact that these societies were now comfortable with the apparatus of civilization as a form of human organization that had been developed in the River Valley period makes it easier not just to assimilate the basic developments, but to use them in combination with new technologies to expand further. With the partial exception of the Mediterranean, the achievements of these classical civilizations represented fairly durable expansions of the territories open to the institutional and cultural characteristics of the classical civilizations. There would be later periods in which China would be curtailed, truncated geographically, but most of the time China pops back in world history associated with the territory that was established in this period, or maybe a bit more. The same holds for India if we view India as a cultural unit and not simply a political one. And the same may hold to some degree for the reassertions, the recurrent reassertions of the Persian tradition. Okay, expansion. Following expansion, all of these societies faced the need to develop an apparatus of integration that would allow the expanded territories to be successfully utilized and maintained. Now, I don't mean to pretend that individuals in these societies sat down and said, gee, we're bigger than our River Valley predecessor. We better figure out some new ways to do things. But implicitly, that's what happened. And sometimes the policies obviously were quite explicit. The Chinese government very deliberately relocated northern Chinese from the Yellow River region down into the south to develop a coherent kind of population loyalty amid the very diverse ethnic and linguistic picture of South China. This move was resented in South China. It wasn't a smooth development, but a very clear realization on the part of the Chinese leadership that expanded territory to be maintained in the orderly fashion that China's values emphasized needed this kind of deliberate integration policy, including emphasis on the importance of the Mandarin Chinese language as the common currency for bureaucrats and other leadership elements in China as a whole, regardless of where located. Rome in its imperial period would obviously equally try to emphasize a combination of relocation of groups of Roman citizens, the stationment of a certain number of military garrisons as a deliberate response to the clear challenge. You've got a great big territory here. How do we hold it together? Okay, more generally, and here's where we go beyond explicit policy to implicit realization of opportunity. More generally, the classical civilizations emphasized three basic integrating devices, and they all did it even though their specific forms varied considerably. One, perhaps most obvious, economic integration. All of these societies traded to some extent beyond their borders, but their main emphasis was in developing economic communication trade patterns that would connect the various parts of the expanded territories and make them useful in terms of specialization and exchange. Thus, most obviously, the Chinese developed regular interaction between the wheat-growing regions of North China and the rice-growing regions of South China, deliberately creating massive canals, because the rivers didn't flow in those directions, deliberately creating massive canals that would facilitate this kind of exchange. Same thing happened in a more familiar fashion in the classical Mediterranean. Mediterranean rulers and merchants eagerly developed contacts with regions that could most successfully grow grain, like North Africa and Sicily, and formed exchanges between these regions and areas like Greece itself that was less suitable to grain growing, more successfully adapted to grape and olive culture. Okay? In all instances, then, exchanges developed that would maximize the economic utility of these expanding territories and also integrate them. Second integration device, really crucial, culture. All of these societies, again, I don't mean that there was a coherent plan, all of these societies introduced key cultural systems, interestingly, in all cases in the 6th and 5th centuries BCE. The cultural systems might be Confucianism, Taoism, Hinduism, Buddhism, Zoroastrianism in the Persian case, Greco-Roman philosophy and art. Very different statements, but in all cases, cultural systems, philosophic and or religious statements combined with artistic traditions, traditions that could then be expanded through the empire as a whole, at least among elites, to provide something of a cultural glue. Again, I don't want to suggest that Confucius or Socrates or Plato were deliberately serving the purpose of civilization expansion, but the way their teachings were disseminated and adopted actually had that effect. And the third, most obvious integrating device, although in some ways it was the most complicated, was political integration itself. No surprise. This was a period of empire. Not empire all the time, but empire recurrently, because in all cases, there was an effort to take advantage of the territorial expansion of the civilization to build imperial structures that would utilize economic and cultural coherence, but also enhance them in turn for purposes of ultimate maintenance. China developed the most consistent imperial tradition. Greece tried it. Alexander tried it. Rome obviously was particularly successful. This was, however, a recurrent effort, more than a consistent one. The Persian imperial tradition, although shorter-lived, was obviously significant. And as noted already, India had its two major periods of empire as well. In all cases, then, economic, cultural, and political integration accompanied the expansion of civilization and, in turn, reinforced it. Okay, the result, pretty clearly, constituted achievements that later societies in these regions and elsewhere would look back on with awe and reverence. Iranians today point with pride to the achievements of Cyrus the Great and the ruins of the great Persian cities. Indians look back on Ashoka and the Mauryan dynasty as one of the great periods of Indian tradition. And many peoples look back on Greece and Rome as a sort of reference point for their own identities. So, each of the classical traditions outlived its own existence by providing an opportunity for emphasis, for identity formation, for a variety of societies that would come later on. But more important, each of the classical societies generated value systems and institutions that would also outlive the societies themselves. We call this period classical because of both the reverence and the fact that it was formative. And we will see institutions, cultural patterns, artistic patterns, even economic and technological values crop up later on that hark back directly to the legacy of these classical societies in this important period in world history.
Lecture 5, Cultural Change in the Classical Period.
Our discussion today focuses on cultural developments in the classical period. I want to make two basic arguments. The first one, which I'll sort of just assert, is that when you look at the various kinds of changes that occurred in the classical period, political changes, great battles, that sort of thing, ultimately, the factors that reshaped cultures in this period probably turn out to be the most important of all. I'll illustrate this, among other things, by talking about how cultural developments in each of the classical civilizations moved some people away from what previously had been cultural staples in the human experience up to that point. The second point I want to make involves the claim that while the most obvious result of cultural change in the classical period was the development of cultural signatures for each of the major civilizations, Chinese culture versus Indian culture, etc., you can also look at cultural developments in this period in terms of commonalities. So we'll play that tension. No question, sharp cultural distinctions emerged, and they remain important to this day. But there were also some shared features that we need to pay attention to in assessing the classical period as well. Culture is an obviously vital but slightly elusive part of the human experience. We're talking about culture not just in terms of great ideas or artistic forms, but basic beliefs, values, and assumptions. The human species is not the only species to have cultures. Various other higher mammals and some birds seem to have cultures in the sense of signals that can vary from one population to the next and potentially change over time. But human beings pretty obviously depend very heavily on culture because, relatively speaking, we don't have a lot of basic instincts. One of the reasons we need to spend so much time teaching children and why adulthood comes so late after birth is we need to work the cultural element into the human psyche so that people will be able to understand the world around them and obviously communicate with other people in their own societies. Cultures undoubtedly emerged early, and we've referred to this in earlier lectures. Quite early, it turns out, people began to develop some cultural awareness of death and some cultural practices that would surround death. We've seen that by the time of the early River Valley civilizations, different cultural forms emerged, obviously distinct artistic expressions, Egypt different from Mesopotamia, etc., apparently different beliefs about death, different moods, greater cheerfulness in the Egyptian case, a somewhat greater melancholy in the case of Mesopotamia. So cultural identities and cultural signals were hardly new in the classical period. But without trying to oversimplify, it's really probably true that for most people, even at the height of the River Valley period, cultural approaches centered around two or three fundamental features, with local variation simply embellishing those basic features. In the first place, it is probably fairly natural in the human experience to have a strong initial belief in polytheism, in a multitude of gods or divine spirits that will activate various forces of nature that will help explain different kinds of occurrences, the rising of the sun, storms, etc. So polytheism was a well-established cultural feature during the River Valley Civilization period and doubtless before. Shading off from this was a strong tendency to believe in magic, to believe that certain kinds of rituals or incantations could move spirits of nature, could help prevent bad things from happening, or even more commonly, because the most common form of magic was white magic, more commonly, to motivate good things. By the time of the River Valley civilizations, a third element had frequently been added, and that was an argument that the rulers of the society, the rulers of these new civilized states, were themselves either directly inspired by gods or were themselves gods. In Egypt and early China, the divinity of rulers seems to have been established. In Mesopotamia, it was more a claim that the gods were directly advising the kings and other rulers. During the classical period, these staples, polytheism, belief in magic, belief in the divinity of rulers, were not overturned, but they were modified, which is what I'm going to come back to after we take up the more readily available point about the establishment of cultural identities. As we discussed in the previous lecture, the classical period was marked by the emergence of key cultural figures, mainly in the 6th and 5th centuries BCE, Confucius and Lao Tzu in China, Zoroaster in Persia, Socrates and his philosophical heirs in 5th and 4th century Greece, Buddha in India. These figures and their overlap in time is a really intriguing coincidence. These figures drew together prior traditions in the regional culture, solidified these traditions, added to them, and came up with coherent and widely appealing statements that helped shape distinct cultural identities in each of the classical areas. Zoroaster, for example, emphasized the importance of the tension between supernatural forces of good and of evil, an interesting approach to the divinity that would frame the human experience. Chinese culture was particularly shaped by Confucius and Confucius's interpretation of earlier Chinese tradition. There, the emphasis was on the importance of political order and hierarchy. Confucius believed that people were fundamentally good if properly educated, so that they would realize their duties to society as a whole, duties of wise stewardship and sympathetic leadership in the case of the ruling groups of society, the gentlemen, obligations of productive work and deference to one's social betters on the part of the masses in society. The focus, again, was on this world and the qualities that would go into political orderliness. But classical Chinese culture was also shaped by the religion of Taoism, which emphasized the importance of harmony with nature, the importance of contemplation, the importance of spiritual attunement to the natural world around them and to the balance that each human being should seek. These two basic idea packages, Confucianism and Taoism, were not necessarily directly at odds, but they obviously had significant and different emphases. Indian culture was shaped by the emergence of Hinduism, an evolving religious belief that originated with the stories brought in by Indo-European migrants and invaders, stories that were summarized in oral epics that were gradually written down and gradually also made more abstract. So what was initially a set of stories could be culled for moral and spiritual meanings. Indian religion was also was initially shaped by the priestly caste, which remained important, but it evolved from a priestly statement to a more sophisticated and varied religion, so that one moves during the classical period from a period of epic and mythology development to the emergence of the priestly caste to the emergence of a more robust and sophisticated Hindu religion. But classical Indian culture was also shaped by the emergence of Buddhism, which shared many beliefs with Hinduism, but quarreled with Hinduism over, first, the belief in the caste system. Buddhism was much stronger in its emphasis on fundamental human spiritual equality rather than a division of people into different social categories that also had different levels of spiritual significance. And Buddhism disputed Hinduism's emphasis on priestly rituals and detailed observances as the proper path toward spiritual development. Buddhism rather took up a strand of Hinduism that emphasized the importance of contemplation, of ascetic withdrawal from the world, as the chief path to spiritual advancement. Classical Mediterranean obviously did not, until the advent of Christianity, produce a major religion. It rather utilized the polytheistic religion brought in again by Indo-European invaders, but it infused this religion with new artistic qualities, with literary representations that could allow the gods and goddesses to be used in terms of ethical models and ethical injunctions, and it added increasingly an overlay outright of more abstract philosophy, including an interest in scientific speculation, an interest in exploring the powers of reason. So, in the three major classical civilizations, one sees the emergence of powerful religious and philosophical statements, each with a fairly distinctive twist. And if Zoroastrianism is added in for Persia, you have a fourth statement. So, point one, obvious but really fundamental. The classical period, as it was shaped by individual thinkers and by the larger evolution of basic cultural forces, the classical period produced distinct cultural signatures that would mark Chinese approaches, Indian approaches, Mediterranean approaches, and to a degree, Persian approaches, not only at that time, but for some time to come. These approaches obviously need to be interpreted in terms of their individual meanings. The division between, for example, the dominant Indian approaches through Hinduism and Buddhism and the more secular emphases of Confucianism and the classical Mediterranean, this division is obvious and fundamental. All of the classical cultural systems were bent on creating a framework for ethical behavior. But in the case of India, whether the emphasis was Hindu or Buddhist, the basic justification for ethical behavior lay in divine sanctions in the sense of spiritual advancement that would result from doing the right thing. The Hindu ethical concept of dharma, for example, which specifically urges that if one obeys one's caste obligations in this life, one will have the opportunity for spiritual advancement in subsequent spheres of existence. This was a direct use of religious and spiritual motivation to underwrite the appropriate ethical code for behavior in this world. In contrast, Confucianism, although it certainly credited the notion that there was a divine order, had no particular interest in exploring that order, and no particular interest either in using that order to help justify ethical behavior in this life. Ethical behavior in this life should be a function of appropriate recognition of the individual's obligation to the larger society. It should follow from one's place in society. Again, gentlemen obligated to wise rule and sympathetic treatment of one's inferiors, ordinary people obligated to deferential behavior and a devotion to productive activity for the general good. These are secular justifications for ethical behavior. And on the whole, although the Mediterranean culture certainly used religion and used some stories of religious intervention in life to help justify the ethical system, the basic philosophical tendency in classical Greece, Hellenism, and later Rome was to urge that the reasons for ethical behavior should be found in individual explorations of ethical imperatives and the relationship between the individual and larger social obligations. Again, in the main, a secular justification. The most obvious result of the classical cultural systems, in addition to providing obvious grist for comparative work, including the comparison between dominantly secular and dominantly religious approaches, the most obvious result of the classical cultural systems was to create something of a common language for elites. Elites in China might individually oscillate between interest in Taoism and interest in Confucianism, but both packages were initially developed for elite consideration and elite use, and both packages helped shape a common elite cultural experience across the expanding territory of classical China. And the same could be argued for elite culture in the Mediterranean, where school systems, among other things, helped inculcate the beliefs of the philosophers. The cultural systems and their elite audience were also reflected in predominant artistic forms. For example, the characteristic restraint and spare depictions of nature that predominate in Chinese art have something to do with Confucian injunctions for personal restraint, for emotional control, and also, probably even more, with the Taoist interpretation of the importance of balance with and harmony with nature. Indian art, more sensual, more vibrant, one might argue, has something to do with the religious system that Hinduism encouraged, with the sense of the vigor of individual gods and goddesses as representation of the larger divine essence. Classical Mediterranean art, with its monumentality, its emphasis on balance in literature as well as art, certainly correlates rather closely with some of the predominant emphases in Mediterranean culture more generally. Okay, we're talking again about what became cultural signatures, signatures that could be widely recognized by elites, that would shade over into the most widely disseminated public art, that constituted something of a cultural package that would provide identity within the civilization, at least at the level of high culture, elite culture, and would provide some possible distinctions between the cultures that would be encountered from the outside. The variations among these identities should not, however, obscure some key basic similarities. Point one, to go back to my earlier argument. All of these evolving cultural systems moved, at least to some degree, I would argue, away from some of the previous cultural staples that had defined river valleys and earlier human experience. They moved away to some degree, at least, from polytheism. Confucianism does not deny the possibility of a variety of gods, but again, the system is not particularly interested in exploring the particular nature of divinity or divinities, nor is Taoism, more spiritual, but not particularly focused on any kind of polytheistic expression. Confucianism and even more Taoism might also detract from any belief in the importance of magic. Taoism would later merge a little bit with magical practices, but at this early point, both of these systems tended to caution away from the notion that there were easy ritual approaches to manipulation of spirits of nature. All of the systems also tended to move at least partially away from the river valley emphasis on the divinity or divine inspiration of the ruling class. Confucianism, to be sure, was compatible with a belief that the emperor was a son of heaven, a sort of vague invocation of divine framework and inspiration, but it normally shied away from any explicit claim that the emperor was himself a god. The Indian religion specifically detracted from any claim of direct religious possession on the part of the ruling class. And although a few Roman emperors would dabble in religious claims, for the most part the Mediterranean value system urged that rulers needed to justify themselves by wise rule, by appropriate identification with ethics,